It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome, welcome to Money for Lunch. Man, I'm excited to have you here. All right. All kidding aside, I am excited to have you here. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal thing. Was watching, is it Good Morning America? Good Morning, anyway, one of the Good Morning shows. And they were showing a clip of Will Smith's latest movie called Collateral Beauty. It looks really good. The other movie that looks really good is Sully, the guy who, Captain Sully, who landed the plane on the Hudson there. And it shows all the behind scenes of what he had to go through. So both of these movies, I'm excited to see. Why am I talking about this? No particular reason. Just I like movies, and these two really kind of stick out to me. And specifically Sully, because all we got to see from Sully was he was being portrayed as a hero, and we didn't get to see what was happening to him in the back scene there. When you're in a very heavily regulated work environment, the government steps in, they isolate you, they really investigate, and if they can, you know, make it, I don't know if they're looking to pin it on you, maybe they are, but they're certainly looking to investigate to see if you did everything you could in your powers to make things happen correctly. Does that make sense? So I'm excited to see those movies. Everything in life that I think, how do I want to phrase this? Everything in life that requires a specific result requires a plan of action, right? There's a formula for losing weight. There's a formula for gaining muscle. There's a formula for setting up your retirement correctly, right? And a lot of us don't know the formulas, and therefore we struggle. Well, my first guest today, Thomas Schmidt, he's an independent investment advisor located in my hometown of Houston, Texas. His firm specializes in managing the accumulation of wealth and then for the proper planning for income retirement. He is a rock star's advisor, which makes you the rock star investor. Thomas Schmidt, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thanks for having me, Bert. Great to be here.
Me, I'm excited to have you back, and I'm excited because we're going to be talking about something that a lot of people have, and I think a lot of people misuse, misunderstand, or are mystified by it, and that is the good old 401k and some of the things that you can do with a 401k. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is 401k diversification. What is this, and how do you diversify within a 401k?
Well, first of all, 401k is designed to basically have automatic diversification. When it's set up by the plan sponsor, it has a vast array of generally mutual funds that cover the various investment sectors and types, you know, stock funds, bond funds, small cap, large cap, that sort of thing. But that's the diversification that's being provided to you. It's not necessarily the diversification that you would create. And over time, a lot of the regulatory burden has been put on the plan sponsor or the employer. So they've created additional investment options, which may or may not add to your diversification. But what it does, it takes some of the burden off of them. And those are things like retirement date funds, also called target date funds, that sort of thing, which are more generic and less specific, as you were just mentioning, proper planning. Those would be what I would consider outside the realm of the proper planning.
Gotcha. Well, go ahead. You were saying something?
No, I say that the way they work is they're a, let's call it a target date fund 2025, 2030, 2040. What they do, they say, okay, if you don't know what to do because you know what the underlying benefits of the options you have are, then just choose one of these. And they're chosen based on your retirement date, which is calculated very simply. What's your age? Assuming everybody retires at 65, then here's where you should be.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right, so let me ask you this real quick. How would someone go about figuring that out? I mean, how do you do a target date or retirement date? So will you have all that worked out like that?
Well, what happens is, you know, behind that fund managers assume that if you're, let's say, 25 years out from retirement, then you can take X amount of risk. So they build a portfolio in that target date fund, which builds in that amount of risk. But the one of the flaws with that is you and I are roughly the same age, but we might have vastly different needs for our retirement investment. You know, our risk for tolerance may be different. I may need to work a lot longer than you do, so I can maybe take more risk since I'm going to be in the workplace earning longer than you are. Our family situation will be different. So what you do is you take all these different people with different sort of investment profiles and you try to homogenize them into one group of people that's age X, going to retire in X years. And what you come up with is a rounded portfolio that's probably not the best for either one of us. Dare say not the best for most of the people that are in it. But
right.
That's what you come up with. And again, the reason for doing that was to give relief to the employer for their fiduciary responsibility, give them a defense to that, versus saying, look, we're adding this in there because it's the best option for me.
Gotcha. All right, so let me ask you this. Because, again, I think a lot of us, me included, we set up this 401k, we kind of set it and forget it. We don't read the voluminous amount of paperwork that goes with it because it's all in legalese and in this tiny print. So what should I be doing? I mean, because obviously, as you already suggested, the plan is set up for one size fits all, but we know that not one size does fit all. So, you know, what should I be doing to maybe avoid some of these flaws or pitfalls?
Well, let me just say that. First of all, I say one size fits all if all are that one size.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
All are not that one size, right? So, well, you know, there's things you can do, things that you can do right off the top of your head. You know that there's a lineup of funds. If nothing else, try to trudge through some of that voluminous information and create yourself at least, if not the most appropriate, at least a diversified portfolio. But there are other things you can do within your plan that you may not even know you can do. In fact, I've run into situations where I tell a client, you know, have you thought about this? It might be something we can do in your plan. They go ask their benefit people. Benefit people don't even know. Then they call their plan custodian. They say, oh, yeah, you can do that. And there are a couple things. One is getting advice. Let's start with the easiest one. Getting advice in your existing plan options, the ones that are there.
Right.
You can get some, you know, of course, let's remember that all of those plans, 401k, 403b, all those retirement type contributory plans are fraught with regulation and government rules because they're qualified and there's a lot that goes with that. A lot that goes with that also has to do with how can I give advice to someone in that situation? Because I'm regulated just as heavily, just as well. But with the lineup that you have, there are independent advice that's available to you using just your options. If your plan won't allow you to do the things that I want to talk about shortly, you can still use the options, get independent, objective advice on what's best suited for you. You do a little risk profile. We take the entire lineup, the entire inventory of options you have available, and we stick them in, and we do portfolio analysis and allocation based on that. So we'll come back with a recommendation that says, okay, out of these choices you have, now start contributing your week, biweekly, monthly, whatever contributions to this allocation.
Right.
And each month, we run through that same type of analysis and say, okay, this month you should be contributing to these. Now, keep in mind that that doesn't mean it's a wholesale change of fund allocation every month. It may be that when we grade them, this month one is out and another one's in, so change that allocation. And the idea is that you're constantly getting good, up-to-date, graded information on the funds you have available. And then on a less frequent basis, say quarterly, do an examination of your entire fund balance, account balance, rather, and
right.
Say, okay, that should be allocated to these funds. So you can reallocate based on that, reallocate the balance based on a quarterly, semi-annual review and that sort of thing.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this. Do you think that there is value in a retirement date fund?
Yes, there's value as opposed to not investing in your 401k. There's value in, you know, throwing darts at your list of options that you have available. I mean, it does get you invested, and you are putting in there regularly with every pay period, so you're developing a habit of investing for your retirement. All those things are valuable.
Sure.
I just think that it's not hard to beat the flaws in it by getting some extra help and understanding what's better for you instead of what's better for 1,000 people your age that may or may not retire at the same time.
Right. All right. So let me ask you this then. Beyond the value you just spoke of, beyond those opportunities, do employees participating in the plan? What opportunities do you see employees participating in the plan have for diversification? I mean, you mentioned doing this quarterly review. That obviously makes sense. Anything else?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great question. That's where we spend a lot of our time at Heritage, is working with participants in the plan, not the employer. That's not in our scope. We're trying to work
right.
with the individual. And one of the options they have, in fact, it's an option that's in over 100,000 401k type plans. And it's what I alluded to earlier, that sometimes the benefits people don't know about. But there's a thing written into the plan that allows the participants to open what is called a self-directed option or a brokerage window. It's an option in the plan, so your money never leaves the plan. It's always reported in the plan, but you put it into a self-directed option. And once somebody has their funds in there, then we can open up their investment options to a much broader range of options, a much more diverse range of options. We can add professional money management to that money to do things that are not correlated to the rest of the market. We have the ability to manage that on a more proactive basis than a mutual fund, which is managed for 100,000 people. And so there's not much, let's put it this way, that particular money manager managing that fund isn't quite as concerned about your particular situation as he is for the overall results of the fund.
Okay,
and
go ahead.
No, so adding that professional money management is an element that you just can't get through the basic options provided by the plan.
All right. This is one of the reasons I love Money for Lunch, because I just learned something I had no idea of, and I think a lot of people are going, what? So if I understand you correctly, I can open a self-directed option within my 401k that allows me to bring in Thomas Schmidt or somebody like Thomas Schmidt to give me professional help in optimizing my money, my retirement. Is that what I'm understanding?
Part and parcel. That's correct. And it's not in every plan. It has to be allowed by the plan. Like I said,
okay.
Over 100,000 plans allow for that. And what it allows me to do is not just to bring in advice, but to actually bring in management on that money.
Wow.
Separate and apart from the other options that you have. And the money is reported in the plan. It's all worked out through the custodian, because what you do is just move money into the self-directed option, and then we take it and allocate it towards whatever we see as the most suitable investment option that's available to you.
Now, so what are the risks? I'm thinking, you know, well, Let me just ask you, what are the risks when you're doing something like this?
The risks are, let me say, no more or less greater than the other options you have. You have investment risk for the money that's in the self-directed option. You know, you have market risk. You have all those things. But with the professional management, you know, we take the money. We understand your risk profile. We understand your ultimate objectives for that retirement money, and we manage it to mitigate the risk while still trying to meet your investment objectives. So they're really not any greater. I mean, the risks are only as much as the portfolio that you construct out of those
right.
separate funds.
Yeah. So the risks are basically inherently the same. I mean, if you're currently right now you're investing in a bunch of young startup companies, and now you open up this 401 directed option, and maybe let's say you're going to start buying blue chip stocks to offset what may happen with the startup companies. Your risks are the same. I mean, like you said, you're opening yourself up to the risk and the volatility of the market, which is inherent in any 401k. Anybody in 2007, 2008, 2009 can attest to the 401k is at risk just like any other investment opportunity out there.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the risk to the employer becomes less, because for all the money in a plan that goes to a self-directed option, the employer actually gets off the hook for their fiduciary responsibility, because they have no control over where that money is invested. Whereas if it's in the plan developed options, then that's in their control, and they have a responsibility each year to manage those, change those, do whatever. But once it's out, it kind of takes the monkey off their back on those, which would, you would think, tend to have employers know more about that and not be reticent to talk about that. But that's why a lot of people don't know about it, because the companies don't really go out of their way to talk about it. The benefits people a lot of times don't know it's there, because it's buried in the plan document, which is part of that voluminous information you were mentioning that often doesn't get read.
Right, right. No, that's amazing. I'm just blown away. This is something that is not even mentioned. And again, it may be in that voluminous paperwork, as you said, you know, but it's not really talked about. It's not taught at the employee level. So it's an amazing thing. All right. So let's wrap this up. What are your thoughts on would want to do this, where should they start? Give us some ideas.
Well, first place to start would be check with your in-house benefits people and inquire if there is a self-directed option or brokerage window option available in your plan. If the answer is no, don't stop there. Check with your custodian, whether it's Schwab or Fidelity or whomever, because a lot of times the benefits people aren't fully informed, and the custodian would be, and find out if that option is available. If that option is available, then it's time to talk, see if it's right for you, see what you want to do. And what I say, I would never recommend you take all of your money in 401k and put it in there, because part of the reason you put it in there is to increase diversification. If you take everything out and put it in there, and now you don't have any of the options that the company gives you, just by virtue of that, you've decreased your diversification. So
right.
It's a way to increase diversification, get other investment options available to you that the company doesn't include in the plan. And I guess my first suggestion would be, if you find that out and you find that it's available to you and it's true, then the first thing you should do is call me above all else.
Right.
To talk about
it. I love that.
And see if,
yeah.
see if it's good. And if it fits for you, then it's a painless thing to do. If it doesn't
yeah.
fit for you, then I'll tell you.
Yeah, I like that. And here's the thing. Here's the number one thing that I appreciate about what Heritage does and what you stand for, and that is you look at each individual, you know, on their own basis, their unique needs, and, you know, and that's so extremely important, because, look, your broker doesn't do that. Most financial advisors think they do that, but they really don't. They're captive, and they can only sell you certain types of investment or insurance options. You know what, Thomas, we're getting close to the end of the segment. Any closing thoughts on 401ks?
Well, yeah, and maybe one day we'll get to revisit some other opportunities available to everybody. But let me just say that your 401k, when you come to retirement, might well be your largest asset. Probably will be your largest retirement asset. And
right.
don't think that somebody else has total control and is pulling the strings of that. You have options. You have opportunities. Take control. Take charge of that. Investigate it. And then when you find out what your options are, explore them with just as much zeal and zest as you would just the plain old options that are given to you in the plan.
I love it. I love it. Thomas Schmidt, independent investment advisor located in Houston. You can find out more about Thomas and his team at heritagefinancialhouston.com. HeritageFinancialHouston.com. Thomas Schmidt, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you, Bert, and look forward to it again.
All righty. Good stuff there from our friend Thomas Schmidt, independent investment advisor. And guys, in case you haven't figured this out, you need somebody who's an independent investment advisor, okay? Just throwing that out there. Most investment advisors aren't independent, and they're not as independent as you think they are. So make sure that you get that checked out. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. My next guest, Grant Baldwin. Grant Baldwin is a creator of the Booked and Paid to Speak training program, a nationally known keynote speaker and author. His podcast and training site is The Speaker Lab, provides weekly training to speakers at all levels of their business. As a speaker, Grant has given hundreds of presentations and has spoken to over 400,000 people in 45 different states through leadership conferences, conventions, and other events. His book and curriculum for students, Reality Check, is taught in 400-plus schools around the country. Grant Baldwin, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks for letting me hang out with you guys today.
You bet, you bet. And we were trying to figure out how we connected. I think we connected on Instagram. I'm saying that because I know your Speaker Lab sounds very familiar to me, and I believe you guys are on Instagram. Is that true?
Yeah, we're on all the various social media platforms, so I'm sure we've crossed paths at some point somewhere along the way.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm just doing a shout out to your Instagram. For you guys who are on Instagram, you can check out the Speaker Lab and hook up with Baldwin and his team there, Grant and his team there. Let's talk about this. Public speaking as a profession, is one of those professions, kind of like acting. Kind of like being an author, it's you know, this very ease of entry, right? There's no cost or very minimal cost to get involved, but it's very, very difficult to make a livable income.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy and a good parallel there with acting, or you know, being in a band or a musician or an artist of some form. That it seems like, you know, you don't necessarily need any type of degree, and you don't need to necessarily jump through any hoops for credibility in order to do it. But like you said, the number of people that do it on a full time scale and do it on a big level can be a relatively small number, but I think oftentimes we spoke at an event here or there, or we did a free luncheon, or we spoke at something at our church, and we think, well, I could do that, or I got some pats on the back or an attaboy, and some people are like, you should do more of this. And we have this kind of this mentality of like, I would love to do more of this, but I have no idea, like, where do you begin? How do you know how much to charge? Where do you know, or where should you speak, and how do you find gigs, and how do you connect with decision makers? And so I think for certainly a lot of people, speaking is one of those aspirational types of careers, but we just have no idea how to get started or how to begin.
Right. Right. So why don't we start there? You know, if you're talking to somebody who has aspirations to become a booked and paid for type speaker, somebody who might be able to make either a part-time or full-time income at this, what should be their first step or first few steps?
Yeah, well, I think one of the first big things you have to ask yourself is why? Why is it that you want to speak? And then kind of on a related note is how does speaking fit into your business? Because one of the great things about speaking is that it can look a lot of different ways for a lot of different people. So meaning that there are some people that speak 100 times a year, and they get paid for those 100 events. They get paid, you know, either very little or a lot, and that's how they make their living. There's other people who speak 10 times a year, and they speak for free, but they use it as lead generation for maybe their coaching or consulting business, or maybe to sell some type of product or course. So there's a lot of different ways that you can use speaking in your business. So I think it's always important for people to start by figuring out, like, why am I doing this? What's the win in the business for me? So from there, once you kind of figure that out, the other two questions that I always challenge people to answer is, who is it that you want to speak to? Who is it that you want to speak to? One mistake a lot of speakers make is that we just think, well, I want to speak to humans. I just want to talk to everybody. I just want to make a difference. And, you know, we're coming from a good place, and that's great, and that's cute, and that all. But that is really, really hard to market if I'm trying to be all things to all people. You just can't do that. So you have to be super, super clear about who it is that you speak to. And then the third question would be, what is it that you speak about? What is it that you speak about? So why do you speak? Who do you speak to? What do you speak about? And so then the third question of what is it that you speak about, related to the who, is that you can't speak about anything. And one of the worst things that a speaker can say is, if someone were to ask them, what is it that you speak about, if their reply is, well, I can speak about anything, or what do you want me to speak about? I can speak about that. Like, that's a horrible thing to do, because if you think you can speak about anything, you really can speak about nothing. And so you really want to be super clear on those three questions of, why is it that you want to speak? Who do you want to speak to? What do you speak about? And once you know those answers to those questions, then the marketing side becomes a lot simpler and a lot
– Yeah. You know what? That is so funny, because that's really – some of the same mistakes that people make in marketing. Who do you want to sell this product to? Everybody. Yeah, you can't do that. It seems kind of weird to say that, but the truth is, you have a specific audience that wants your product, or your ideal audience that you want to serve. The same thing with your ideal audience that you want to talk to, because you have an ideal, you know, you have a specific or ideal message that you want to deliver. And your message about whatever it is isn't really for everybody. It's for those people who are really excited about that category.
Right. And, you know, another little tip here is, the more specific you are, the better. So I find some people that would say, well, I want to talk to women. Okay, well, that's great, but that's half the population. So let's narrow down. Okay, I want to talk to women who are also mothers. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. Okay, but I want to talk to women who are mothers, who are entrepreneurs, who are trying to balance building their business while at the same time raising their kids, and they feel that tension. Okay, now we found like a really specific subset here of audience of potential audiences that you could speak to, and so the more narrow you become in that, the more focused and crystal clear you are in that, it's a lot easier to find the audiences where you would be a good fit. Whereas if you're just saying, well, I just want to speak to women, well, that could look a lot of different ways in a lot of different types of conferences and settings. So the more specific and the more clear you are, again, on the who and the what, the easier it is to find speaking engagements.
Okay, now, and I want to talk about this because this is that same oxymoron that we hit in marketing. So I want to talk about this because I know that, Grant, you probably get this question. Well, Grant, if I narrow it down to just, you know, mothers who are entrepreneurs who want work-life balance, I'm going to be, you know, isn't that going to reduce the amount of speaking engagements versus enlarge?
Right. It does, but that's a good thing, meaning that think of it from the perspective of the client who's looking to hire a speaker. Okay, so if let's just play this out. Bert, you run a conference, and I come to you, and you run a conference for financial planners, and I come to you, and we're having a conversation, and I want to be a speaker at your event. And if I'm saying, well, like I speak to financial planners, but then I speak to moms, and I speak to dentists, and I speak to lawyers, and I speak to real estate agents, and I speak to high school students, would you like me to come speak at your event? You're like, I don't know. I mean, it seems like you're just kind of trying to speak at anybody that will give you the opportunity. Versus if I come in and I say, I only speak to financial planners, and here's three different topics that I speak to this audience on. It's much more like, okay, this is the go-to person on this subject or topic. You're going to be a lot more likely to book me versus someone that's the jack of all trades. In the same way that, if I go to the doctor, I may go to a regular physician just for like a checkup, and I'm okay with that. But if I'm going to need some type of like, if I need brain surgery, I don't want to go to the guy that's like, yeah, I did brain surgery one time, so yeah, I guess I could do that. Like, I want to know, like, no, this is all you do, and like, you are the best at that. And so that's the way you really want to think of it as a speaker, is that I'm not someone that like, yeah, I guess I could talk about that topic and 19 other topics, but no, like, this is what I focus on. This is what I do, and it makes you better at the topic and better as a communicator, but it also makes it a lot easier for people to want to hire you.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. So, all right, so the first step is to get really clear as to why you want to speak. The second step is focus on your key, what do you call it, your key audience, right?
Right, yep, who you want to speak to.
Right, and what's the third step?
Number three would be what you want to speak about. So why do you want to speak, and kind of how does it fit into your business? So meaning like what's the win for you? You want to speak primarily to get paid? Do you want to speak for credibility? Do you want to speak to for notoriety? Do you want to speak because you have some type of book or something to sell? Do you want to speak for lead generation, for some other type of product? So why you want to speak and how it fits into the business. And then who do you want to speak to? And then number three, what do you want to speak about?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And that's just, again, that's just general information to launch anybody who's thinking about becoming a speaker, has aspirations. And then if they want to actually get more information, they can go to bookedandpaidtospeak.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, they can absolutely go there. And we've got a free email course that walks people through more in depth on how you actually find and book speaking engagements. One other thing I'd mention real quick, Bert, is we are starting this next week. We are doing a free online virtual summit where we've gathered over 40 of the world's best speakers on the planet, just sharing some of their strategies and tactics of how they've built their business, how they find bookings, how they've built their business beyond the stage, how they've gotten book deals, all of that. And so you can actually get a free ticket for that. It's all virtual. It's all online. You don't have to travel anywhere. It's starting on Monday, September the 12th. And people can register for that by going over to thespeakerlabsummit.com, thespeakerlabsummit.com. And again, it's a totally free ticket you can pick up if you want to come hang out.
Thespeakerlabsummit.com. Get your free ticket. Go out there. Find out some of the do's and don'ts about launching your speaker business. Grant Baldwin, thank you so much for stopping by. Looking forward to have you back again.
Thanks, Bert. Appreciate it, man.
All righty. Good stuff there from Grant Baldwin. about launching your speaker business, or maybe you already have a speaking business and you want to upgrade it, update it, maybe get more gigs, go to thespeakerlabsummit.com and get your free ticket. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break. And then when we come back, we're going to be hanging out with Nolan Bushnell, the guy who started the gaming industry, and he was also smart enough to hire Steve Jobs. When we come back.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
All right, we are back. As I mentioned right before the break there, my next guest, Nolan Bushnell. Nolan Bushnell created an industry when he founded Atari in 1972 and gave the world Pong. Man, do I remember spending literally days playing Pong, the first blockbuster video game. A prolific entrepreneur, he has started more than 20 companies, including Catalyst Technologies, the first Silicon Valley incubator, and ETAC, the first in-car navigation system, not to mention Chuck E. Cheese, Pizza Time Theater. Bushnell was the first and only person ever to hire Steve Jobs, which he details in his 2013 best-selling book, Finding the Next Steve Jobs. Nolan Bushnell, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right, so let's talk about your latest, I don't know if it's your latest project, but at least one of your most recent projects, Brain Rush, brainrush.com. What is Brain Rush?
It's a new way of learning, and it uses mini games to basically perform drill and practice that is extremely efficient for learning facts and concepts, and it has, we have several templates, and the idea really is to employ some of the best brain science to make learning more fast, efficient, and persistent.
I love it. I love it. So if you go to brainrush.com, it says adaptive learning games that anyone can create, share, and play. So this is really kind of unique. So anybody can create, share, and play these games. That kind of gives it a nice community type of environment. I love that idea.
Yeah, and what the real secret sauce is that it is it really is effective. You know, for example, just two or three days a week using one lesson, and kids all of a sudden in Spanish vocabulary, for example, Spanish 1 kids end up with more vocabulary than Spanish 3 kids.
Wow.
So you've truncated 3 years of Spanish 1 year.
Wow. All right, so let me ask you this. Here I am. I am a high-powered CEO. I'm a startup entrepreneur. I'm a stay-home mom. Why should I use BrainRush.com?
Our main focus is K-12, but it turns out that we are I'm about to ramp up a thing called Snap Institute, which is a entrepreneurial school. But it's not quite ready yet. But go into Snap Institute, and you can sign up and learn about all the entrepreneurial tricks of the trade. And I'm actually in the process of creating a whole bunch of video lessons for that, and I'll be actually teaching a couple of classes.
Oh, that'd be cool. That would be outrageous. And it's called SnapInstitute.com?
Correct.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right, so Brain Rush is K through 12, and this is, I think, kind of a neat idea because we, meaning all of us humans, we tend to learn better in a fun, interactive environment.
Exactly. For example, I'd be willing to bet that you don't know the location of every country in Africa.
If you would agree.
If you take 10 minutes and play that particular, I think we have, those are two different brain rushes, so you maybe have to do 20 minutes. You will know absolutely all the names of the African countries and where they are and be able to point them out on a map. You'll absolutely be able to do that.
Man, that's outstanding. And I'm looking at the website. Again, guys, the website is brainrush.com. You have a game, and I love this. Where do the commas belong? What a simple idea. And do the games take, are the games short, 10, 20 minutes?
20 minutes would be a long one. I don't think many of them do that, but 10 minutes is sort of the average. But there's an interesting thing. Turns out that everybody doesn't learn at the same rates. But when normalized for time, there are kids who have grown up thinking that they're stupid, when in fact their clocks just run a little bit slower. And, you know, one of these problems with political correctness is that a lot of times you don't say, hey, Johnny's stupid. They say he's a little slow.
Right.
Well, it turns out that that is absolutely wrong, that some kids just are a little slower, but they're cognitively brilliant. And that if given just a little bit more time on tests, a little bit more time to learn things, all of a sudden they perform better than kids who are considered to be average.
Yes, and I agree with that. You know, weaknesses in our the current public school environment is that they are trying to fit the math. It's designed for the masses. So if you're really smart, or if you are, let's say, out of the box in some way, maybe you're a little bit slower. You need more visual aids or more auditory aids, then you may not learn at the same level as the 80% that fit that public school program.
I'm actually working on a speech right now that is labeled The End of the Classroom. And I actually think the classroom as an idea is over. But anytime you have bureaucracy, it'll take a while. But the classroom is so wrong for today's student. Today's student, batch processing of kids does not work. You know, they're used to being able to watch a movie when they want to, a TV show when they want to, not on their schedule, on your schedule. And the other big issue is you have tremendous amount of wasted time in school with disruption. And that's a characteristic of a classroom. Kids should have headphones on, working on their computers. A junior high school and high school should look more like a tech startup than a traditional classroom. That's when you're going to all of a sudden transform into a world where kids are getting value from school rather than just being warehoused.
Man, that's interesting. I like that. The reality is that the way we communicate thought has changed so much, and nowadays, Nolan, it's very common to see a toddler with a tablet.
Exactly. I mean,
and so there's no way that you're going to take this. Go ahead.
Yeah, cool. School was invented way before the internet. And,
right.
And they haven't retooled themselves since the internet, and the internet changed everything. Like, right now, let's think about what we want kids to have. The three characteristics are curiosity, enthusiasm, and self-control. And right now, schools are doing a great job of stamping out creativity. They're doing a great job of stamping out enthusiasm and doing nothing to enhance self-control on the part of students.
Yes.
All the
Absolutely.
Rest of it's rounding error.
Now, part of that has to be because you still have these old, I'll just say it, you have these old thinkers in there. I mean, we have people who are still running the public school system who probably shouldn't be because they're the same people who had trouble, I'm sorry, downloading an app, accessing the internet. They're the kind of people who really should not be in charge of teaching this new generation because they're ill-equipped.
No question about it. And there is this bias towards academics. Like, if you talk to a high school principal, they will, their results in terms of how many of their graduates were able to get into college.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a wrong thing because so many kids go to college and waste a tremendous amount of time and waste a tremendous amount of money getting a degree that is not marketable. I mean, the number of kids with degrees tending bar, driving a cab, Uber's probably the savior of college graduates. And it's criminal. We've reinvented indentured servitude by student loans. Many times, I mean, there's a whole list of occupations that do not pay for their student loans, just won't, let alone, and then, of course, sometimes mom and dad are chipping in, and, you know, mom and dad, they use that for an ocean cruise.
Right. Well, and sometimes, depending on the kid, the ocean cruise is probably a wiser investment. But those are the, I think, just like any group, there's always the exception one way or the other. But again, back to the whole classroom idea of having to retool the classroom. Let me ask you this. Why do you think it's taking so long for people to go, yeah, we need to change this? Because, you know, when I talk to individuals like yourself, when I talk to even young teachers today, just about everybody agrees that we need to do something with the classroom, but yet it's not happening. Why do you think it's taking so long to make these changes?
Because it's primarily bureaucracy and teachers' unions.
Mm.
They have an entrenched fief. The schools are paid for by government. Government is a political organization that tends to focus on their constituency. The teachers' unions pay a lot of money to election campaigns. And as a result, the will to change is not there. Also, a lot of parents are fearful about their kids doing something new and different. And,
right.
And then, you know, just the whole idea, when you talk to people, they will always tell you an anecdote about the teacher that changed their life or inspired them. So these are successful people. And, yeah, hey, there's some exceptional teachers out there, 10%. And there's some extremely crappy teachers out there who essentially can turn off kids to learning forevermore.
Yes.
And there's no correction mechanism that is similar to the private sector. You know, if you're a crappy teacher, just suck it up and endure. I mean, if they were to just track high school dropouts to bad teachers, it'd be really remarkable.
You know, that's an interesting idea. But you're absolutely right. Look, I can tell you on a couple of fingers, the teachers that impacted my life the most and really just gave me a thirst for learning. And I still to this day, I remember the one teacher that was a complete dick as a teacher. And she was a horrible human being, and she just brought it to the classroom. And it's when you hate, if you hate being a teacher, if you go to class and you're dreading it, you need to quit. Do everybody a favor and get out.
Yeah, and that's another big problem. The pension systems are so back-end loaded that most teachers make more money in retirement than they do all the time they were teaching.
Wow.
And it's just, retire at 55 or 50 at 80% of your salary and have longevity, you teach for 30 years and retire at 55. Most people are living to 85 right now.
Sure.
So the math is just so back-end loaded. And a lot of teachers, do you know that half of the teachers who start in education quit teaching within 5 years of graduation? Half.
Wow.
Because, a lot of times a teacher wants to teach because they love kids. And based on starting salaries, which are too low, a lot of times they can't afford. If they have student loans and on a teacher's salary, they can't afford to have their own family. It's just upside down and so messed up. Anyway, I could rant on this for a long time. It's probably not
sure, sure. Well, but
let's talk about something else.
All right. Well,
talk about virtual reality.
Before we change subjects, one more. I want to talk about this because it's so important. How would you fix or innovate or change the student loan scenario? Would you make it interest free or very low interest, or how would you make? What changes would you like to see when it comes to student loans?
I believe that school should be free for anyone at any time. And
okay.
I think that there are so many ways that you can cut costs that the tax system should be, that's building our infrastructure for the future, brain power.
Right.
Let me go through what I call shop for economics.
Okay.
California, typical class size is 32, 35. Okay?
Okay.
That classroom with a prorated portion of the field and what have you can cost about $20,000. We know that the average teacher salary in the state of California is $60,000. Okay? If you're high tenured and you got a master's degree, you can get up to 90. Now, so we've got the teacher in this classroom. We've got the classroom paid for with janitorial and all that. And we haven't quite reached $100,000 yet. And yet we know the state of California spends $10,000 plus for every high school student. So if you multiply $10,000 times 32 students, 35, you get $350,000. Where'd the other $250,000 go?
Good question. Where does it go?
Well, basically,
unions?
It's just waste. It's bureaucracy. You can never throw enough money at a bad system to fix it.
Mm.
The waste and the bullshit will gobble it up. A high school was built in Los Angeles that cost per square foot more than the Ritz-Carlton. Now, Why? Downtown Los Angeles is a million. There's a building that was bought by the California by the Los Angeles School District, million square feet, full of people. No teachers, no students. Just administration.
Wow.
You know, it's just stupid stuff like that.
Yeah.
I believe that a good system, and that's why I think vouchers are the only way you break that. And if you ever want to hear teachers' unions scream, just say, we want to do a voucher system. Give people choice. Oh, my God, that's what a radical, nasty idea that is. I believe that I could create a school using technology that would give a student a significantly better education and job skills for $5,000 a year. And I believe that college should be free. And you know, I mean, if you want it.
So let me ask you this.
I don't feel like.
Hey, welcome back to the Nolan Bushnell Rant Show. No, but you know what? Here's the difference. To me, it's not ranting. I love to hear some of this because you have unique, point of view. But let me ask you this. When you say college should be free, are you saying community college, state college? What about these Ivy League college like MIT or Ivy League colleges, Harvard, things like that. Should they all be free or just your community and state colleges?
Well, let's put it this way. These are private schools. They should be able to charge whatever they want. And
gotcha.
And student loans should be available to those. It turns out that a degree from Harvard, MIT, Yale actually is worth it. Stanford. And so going into debt for that isn't necessarily a bad idea. But if you have a plain vanilla college education, unless you're in the sciences and the engineering fields, maybe biotech, your college education is not monetizable based on the cost.
Right. And I think you gave a great example. I mean, look, if you graduate as a school teacher and you have $60,000 worth of debt, that's a terrible way to start your career.
Yeah. Well, now let's go to the college for a second. Remember going to Physics 1 your freshman year? And you sat in an auditorium with 400 people listening to one professor. What's the economics of that classroom?
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's an old joke. If you want to get rid of pigeons, give them tenure. And they'll quit showing up.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway. I think that we both agree, and I think everybody agrees, we need to retool our American education system. I love this idea, though, of retooling the education system, making public schools free, making your state schools free, and then for those private schools, yeah, they can charge whatever they want. I think that we need to tweak our student loan programs. I think they are kind of abusive. And we didn't mean to get off on this tangent, but we started this because of BrainRush.com. So if you want your kids to have more fun and do better in school, check out BrainRush.com. BrainRush.com is the place to go. Nolan, always good to have you on the show. Looking forward to have you back again, my friend.
Hey, let's do it when we talk about the virtual reality and some of the new things that are happening in games or just the future. You know, it's... Yeah, like I say, I didn't want to turn it into the Nolan rant, but you wound me up.
No problem. It's my fault. My fault. So we'll bring you back and we'll talk about the future. We'll talk about virtual reality. Nolan Bushnell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good stuff there from our friend Nolan Bushnell, the guy who created the gaming industry, hired Steve Jobs, created Atari, and for all you parents out there, he's the guy who also created Chuck E. Cheese Pizza Time Theater. Man, those friggin' bears, right? Remember those bears? Anyway, always good to have you all here, my friends. We appreciate you very much. You make this show happen. Remember, you were created to
tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.